And from the studios at KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, interesting, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake, our first guest, Steve Ellis, CEO of Vutility. Vutility enables residential, commercial, and government users to view their utility usage, be it gas, water, or electric, in real time. The product helps users to become aware of the utility costs, drives down utility bills, and conserves the natural resources used in utility generation.
Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is a previously aired episode. It's Mark O'Connell. He has written a book called The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. The book is about Dr. J. Allen Hynek. He's responsible for coining the phrase close encounters of the third kind. Hynek enthusiastically debunked UFO reports on behalf of the Air Force for years. Then he changed teams. The book is about his transformation from skepticism to true believer and the actual UFO stories that he investigated.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill supporting KPCW. We are celebrating summer at 352 Main with outdoor deck dining and Main Street views, serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Our first guest, Steve Ellis, CEO of Vutility. Vutility enables its users to view the utility usage in real time using smartphone apps that provide real-time guidance and alerting, be it gas, electric, or water utilities. This past April, Vutility was awarded the 2017 Utah Innovation Award in the clean technology and energy sector. Steve Ellis, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here, and we've heard so much about your product. You are also the original inventor of this product. You're not just a business person. You're the person that put this all together.
That's correct.
Tell us about the product.
Well, the original version of the technology, what it was designed to do was get the information in real time about utility usage. So everything from that point forward, everything about our company has been about getting that real-time piece of information that helps people understand what's going on. The biggest challenge for people is that they don't know what they're doing when they do it. And so because they're blind to that effect of what they're spending, they continue to spend until they get that big bill. They don't know what they did wrong. And so they you know, make a new commitment in life. They say, I'm going to save money. The very next day, they forget all about it. They go back to excessive usage. They just don't know what they're doing. And so this is all about getting that information in front of their eyes right away at the moment that they're doing something that they shouldn't.
Right, exactly. And the product is you have an app that is the interface to all of this, and there's a piece of hardware as well. Can you tell me how that works?
Yeah, so the hardware is able to listen to multiple meters that are throughout a city or an area. So one of our devices can listen to between 2,000 to 6,000 homes and all of their meters that are managing or monitoring their utilities. So rather than someone coming and driving around at the end of the month to pick up the information from the utility and using it for billing purposes, our technology is gathering that information in real time because they're always talking, and so we're always listening. And we provide, that's how we're able to get that information into our back-end system and then provide that in real time to whoever needs to see that information. Normally, it's going to be the resident or the utility.
So, Steve, I know you came from the cybersecurity world, so maybe this is a good time to talk about, you know, the fact that a little device, and I think it's the way you describe it, maybe you can hold it in the palm of your hand, that can pick up on 2,000 to 6,000 say residences, in an area or businesses. That sounds kind of Big Brother-ish, and it's a little bit scary, but talk about the security aspect of that.
Yeah, sometimes we do get a question of saying, isn't that a little bit creepy or a little bit illegal that you can listen to that type of information? The reality of it is that these meters are not saying anything about who you are. They don't know where they are. They don't know whose house they're attached to. So when they're transmitting this information, all they're really transmitting is a meter ID and the consumption information. We don't know if it's John Doe down the road. We don't know really who it is. So when someone comes into our experience to claim their meter, so to speak, we still don't know who they are. They can claim it and access it. And there are certain safeguards that prevent multiple people from accessing the same meter's information. But we came at it because of my cybersecurity background. I'm historically an engineer and a very paranoid one at that, being in cybersecurity. So rather than approaching it as, you know, as a Facebook type of approach where let's just share it because we have it, we approached it more from a banking perspective, which is we don't necessarily need to keep this private, but we're going to because that's what we're good at. And we don't know long term what this information might mean to people. So let's just keep it nice and secure right up front.
Okay, so I am a user of water, gas, electric at my house. I currently get notification from the water department, the municipal water department, and it talks about my usage this month compared to all those folks around me, and I do love it. And you're right, as you said just in the beginning, that when you see your usage, there's something that works with our psychology, the way we operate as humans, to make you just become more aware and then try to reduce, right? So if we're talking about someone like me who goes on, I bring the app up and then I've got to enter all my information in terms of just my account information, or my meter information, my account number, how do I do it?
It really depends on how it's working with the utilities in the area. So if the utility isn't on board with utility at the moment, with our company yet, what you can do is just simply put in your meter ID, and then you can activate or basically claim ownership of that meter and move forward with it. In the case where it's we're working with a utility in the area, it's a double authentication. So you'll put in your meter ID, and then you'll put in your utility account number. That's something that only the bill payer would know.
You have a contract with Park City. Is that starting now? Can we go and get an app and start this right now?
It depends on where you are in Park City right now. We have deployed a few test devices throughout Park City just to get a better feel for the lay of the land. If you'll forgive the statement, Park City, topologically speaking, you know, with the hills and mountains everywhere, it's kind of the worst case scenario for a technology like ours to get this information. There's so many pockets of houses or buildings that are hidden or tucked around a mountain. And as you know, radio just doesn't go around mountains very well. So we have to put in a little bit more infrastructure to support all these different pockets and keep it out of sight so that it's not invasive to the city. So there are some devices out there. You can download the app from any of the app stores, put in your meter number, and see if you're in one of those test zones. If you're not, we are working with Park City on the project plans, and we'll have information, not today, but very shortly, on what that rollout will be and when certain areas will have their coverage.
And within the application for residents, there's individual residents, but there's also homeowners associations that could take advantage of this. There are property management companies that could provide a service using this technology to their customers. Let's talk about some of the applications.
Yeah, absolutely. We find on almost a daily basis that the application capabilities continue to grow. But from a multiple property owner or management company, something that's really useful for them is many cases they don't know what each of their tenants are actually using, and they may have included that into the lease on the property. So utilities are just included, especially when we're talking about certain types of businesses. In some cases, you're going to have some businesses that are going to use a lot more utility than another. There was a case in Salt Lake a few years ago where there was an insurance company on a floor in a large office building, and they were using very little energy. But then the building brought in a high-tech company that brought in a data center into that building. And they all of a sudden had to share, because of the terms of their lease, they had to share the utility bills with that extremely high consumer. So that insurance company was able to sue the property owner and get out of their lease and leave the building because of that unfair scenario. But the building owner at the time didn't really have anything to be able to differentiate who's using what. And that's something that our technology can do. Hmm. So for their perspective, they're able to see that, break it down. They're able to provide also visualizations, not only in a mobile app, but also in a full web experience, what's going on in that building. In many cases, the companies that use our technology install a TV on the entrance of a building. We laugh because it's usually like a 70-inch television when we think they should put a monitor on the TV itself. But they put on this really nice kiosk view that shows it shows how much the building is using. It shows to the world that they care about their footprint. Mm-hmm. And it shows what that footprint actually is. So it's a responsible open communication of their awareness and their objectives. So in a commercial scenario, that's one of the great ways that they're going to benefit from it. Residentially speaking, I can't tell you the number of times when I'm either up late at night or up early in the morning driving through a city for some reason, I see sprinklers going off at night, which is when you should sprinkle, which is when you should water your lawn. But I see that they have many of them that are geysering. They're broken, and they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing like at my house. I wouldn't know because I water at night. They don't know that. And those geysers are using up an awful lot of water. And as a homeowner, and I'm also a member of a homeowners association, I'm paying for that water one way or another through my fees. And my fees are going to continue to go up if that loss continues to occur. So this is visibility at multiple levels that helps that responsibility and that reduction of unnecessary usage.
So are there some kind of alerts that you can either... Well, that will be triggered automatically, or that you can set, you know, if I exceed X number of gallons of water per day, you know, send me an alert.
Yeah, so our platform tries to be as uninvasive, again, both in hardware as well as software as it can be. What we know for a fact is that most people out there that have a mobile phone have a ton of apps on their phones that they don't look at anymore. And we assume that although our app is really cool and useful, we're probably going to fall in that category. We're not as important as email.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did instead is we said, rather than just giving them alerts when they're at 50% or 100% usage of their goal or whatever that is, instead we said, let's let them set a monthly goal of how much they want to limit their spending. So they can say, I only want to spend maybe $100 on electricity this month. What the system will do is in real time, it's going to be monitoring their usage all month long, every day. And at any moment, if what they're doing is no longer sustainable, that trend of usage is not going to keep them below that goal, they get an immediate push notification on their phone, even if the app is closed. So we're not pinging them every day saying, here's how you're doing, because those tend to get ignored and turned off. Instead, if you're doing really well, you'll never hear from it. But if what you're doing at that moment is not sustainable, you're going to hear about it right then and there. And that's where the actionable opportunity comes. That's where the behavior mm-hmm. change really comes. If you know that what you're doing at the moment is wrong and you can respond to it right then and then see the effect right then, you immediately have educated yourself in a way that no amount of conservation TV mm. spots or brochures try to educate you on. This is a visceral, hands-on experience where now you know what you've done wrong.
Yeah. I have to admit, I'm sitting here picturing going maybe one step further where when your teenager is taking too long of a shower, for example, it just shuts the water off. Or when your teenager forgets to turn off their bedroom light for 4 successive hours, they ping you. Anyway.
Lynn's into the punitive stuff. She wants those kids punished. I'm with you, by the way.
It's been a long summer.
No, I'm with you, Lynn.
Let's see. So when you say that you have a contract, for example, with Park City Municipal, what is it telling them? What is it? I mean, what is the contract? And how is it helping them to achieve their net zero goals that they have set?
Park City is a little bit of a different opportunity. Normally in our contracts with utilities, it's aimed at providing the information back to the utility in real time that they want to know. In the case of Park City isn't the provider of electricity or natural gas. So the municipality isn't that utility where they have the rights to see that information directly. But what Park City needs to see in order to become a net zero city is the trending of the entire city in different zones. So they'll never see John Doe down the road, what his usage is. They'll see large regions of the city. They'll see these patterns day over day, month over month. They'll be able to set new projects of sustainability and awareness to try and help the city to move toward that direction. in order to become net zero, you have to be able to measure what's going on. And right now, without that measurement, they don't know how far away from that mark they are and how long it will take to actually do that and what types of programs will have what type of effective results. Real-time feedback will tell them which programs are working better than others.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Steve Ellis, who is the CEO and the founder and, well, the chief technology person behind this product at Viewtility. We were speaking in the green room before the show, and intuitively you would think that the utility companies themselves might feel a little threatened by this because if their customers become more efficient, they would sell them less product, that sort of thing. But that's not the fact. That's not the way it works, is it?
Yeah, that's a common myth. The reality is that the utilities have a lot of responsibilities, not only in conservation, but also in being able to maintain a dynamic grid, something that can move forward in time with the new types of energy technologies out there. Solar, wind harvesting, things like that, those are generating energy and they're doing it in dislocated ways. We call them frequently microgrids, which are basically isolated smaller systems that are generating energy. They will typically try and bring that energy back into a larger grid, but in many cases, like in Hawaii, that's forbidden simply because it's so prolific there. It's too difficult. It kind of ran away from them too quickly. In Hawaii, they actually have really stiff penalties for putting energy back into the grid because they can't calculate and manage that grid fast enough with the amount of alternative energy coming into it.
Hmm.
Here in Utah, it's a little bit different. The solar industry didn't move as quickly as Hawaii, obviously not as much sun. But Utah is now a great location with the latest advances in solar. So in that case, a utility needs to know in advance before it gets away from them what that energy load is going to be coming on and off of that grid. And in many cases, the utilities themselves will participate in microgrids. And they need to have that information not only between their microgrids, but also interacting with individual homes or businesses at scale to make sure that that grid is well balanced.
Sure. Tell us about your competition. Do you currently have competition? Do you currently have a window of opportunity? If so, how big is that window?
It's a little bit of both, really. If you don't have competition, I say you don't have a market. We do have competitors, I would say, but in very unusual or I call them indirect ways, indirect competitors. There are companies that will try and provide a snap-in metering component for electricity for a home. The companies that make the meters themselves for the utilities could be considered a competitor, although in many cases we have good relationships with them because of the data that we're able to analyze for them. So yes, you could say that there are competitors, but the reality is there isn't anything that's actually gone end to end and tried to provide the meaningful information to everybody in real time. We're brand agnostic, we're utility agnostic. When one of our devices goes into a city, we're servicing any type of brand of meter and any type of utility, whereas any other provider of a meter collection service would be targeting one utility and one brand only, which becomes really expensive to make sure that the city or the area is up to date with the latest single-sourced product. Here, we're able to provide the solution without having to change infrastructure throughout a city, which saves the city a lot of money.
So you have a contract with the municipality, and that's how we get our water if you live in city limits. What about water outside of Park City limits, just out in the county? Do you have those utilities on as well?
We have had conversations with Summit County.
Uh-huh.
I believe that they're watching very closely to see how the Park City project moves forward.
Uh-huh.
I know that they have strong interest in the solutions. We do have the ability to support the meters that they use. We'll simply cross that bridge, I would assume, pretty soon, but obviously in their due time.
Right. And then Questar and Rocky Mountain Power. And didn't Questar just change its name to...
They were acquired by Dominion Energy.
Yes, okay. So what about those two? Can we get through your app our Rocky Mountain Power metering and Questar, Dominion Energy?
Yeah, our technology does support both of their metering types. So both Rocky Mountain Power, PacifiCorp, and the Dominion meters are definitely supported. Different types of meters can communicate at different rates. Electricity is something where it's going to be communicating frequently because it's something that moves very quickly in a house, whereas with natural gas, especially during the summer, it's so infrequent or the volume of use is so low that those meters chat at a much slower rate.
Okay.
How do you get your products out to the market? And once you get them out to the market, let's say it's a commercial account in Boston, for an example,
Can it be user installed, or is this something that you have to, or a third party needs to get involved in?
We don't generally sell this to an end consumer. The app, of course, is available to an end consumer, but our objective is to try and make this available directly to the utility company or to a solar company, a large company that has a lot of customer base already that would have interest in using it. It reduces our cost of operation and market penetration, but it also provides a value add to those organizations. We require that any company, like a utility, if they do take our technology, they're not allowed to just gather information for themselves for the purposes of building. Part of the origin story of the reason of this company existing, we have an ethical stance where we say that if you are gathering this information about your customers, you must give it back to your customers.
Of course. Okay. And what's the end game? I mean, you're still a very young company. You're venture capital based. Is it acquisition? Is it possibly a public offering?
It's an interesting question. I don't know that we would probably want to go public. That's kind of a complicated ordeal. We find that we have tremendous success throughout different types of markets. So acquisition is certainly on the table in the future. We're not really trying to entertain anything like that today. Right now, we're trying to see if we can actually complete the vision of the company, which is a larger scale throughout at least the United States, as well as some international opportunity, try and make that big change. It's an impact company. And if we don't feel like we are on the way to making that impact and making a solid change, then we're not making that mark yet, and it's not time for us to exit the company.
And will you be able to do that with the existing financing, or will there be additional rounds of venture capital involvement?
I imagine that there will be probably one more round of venture capital for the company. You know, being the majority shareholder, I'm not interested in surrendering much of my company, but I'll do what's necessary in order to make that happen, to make the impact occur.
We're speaking with Steve Ellis, the CEO of Vutility. And I might mention, that is spelled V-U-T-I-L-I-T-I. So kind of like utility, but with an I at the end instead of a Y.
Yeah,
a little V at the beginning.
A little Italian look to it, right?
Yeah.
I like it. So will you talk a little bit about your background? You came from cybersecurity. What made you, you know, was it just the light went on and you had an aha moment? Or how did you evolve into Vutility?
I was actually running another company that I had created, which was a cloud-based retail platform. So my background is in protecting very sensitive information at scale, designing and building those systems as well. So I was busy doing that, and I wasn't really looking to make another company or anything like that. But what happened was the city I live in, Saratoga Springs, you may have seen them in the news recently about water problems. They put in new water metering to try and help everyone conserve because the city is in really great growth right now. And so they put in new metering systems to try and help people conserve, but it didn't work. The meters work, but the consumers don't have access to the information until the bill comes around. And so I called the city and I said, well, if my bill is going to go up just on my water without even using any water, I want to know if something's wrong. I want to know if one of my sprinkler heads is broken. So they said, well, we don't have anything like that. You're going to have to wait till the end of the month. When we find out, you'll find out. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's not going to work. So, you know, if something goes wrong, I'm going to be hundreds of dollars potentially in expenses without even knowing. So my background being what it is, cybersecurity engineer for about 20 years, you know, my duties have been to break into systems and then protect those systems. So I felt like I had
That's
a pretty good background. Yeah, pretty good background to figure out how these things worked and how to get that information. So that was the origin of what we did. And because of that background, we built in a lot of security into the platform just from the beginning.
Mm. So last summer, I worked so hard to not use water. I mean, my grass shows it too, you know, it's very dead. And I was so vigilant about it. And then one day in October, my husband and I went on a bike ride and we came home and some member of our family decided to wash the bikes and then left the hose on and forgot about it. And it wasn't until our neighbor came over literally the next day. It was horrendous. Anyway, and let us know that it was getting moist near her house and possibly her basement. So that would have helped that would have helped. And I am, we do have the smart metering on the water here in Park City, but for some reason there was no notification. Maybe it was over the weekend or something, but wow, if I'd had your app, I would have known.
Yeah. Our app, within about 5 minutes, will typically identify a historical anomaly, something that's wrong. It doesn't match. We use machine learning to try and anticipate and calculate these massive amounts of data and try and help people to prevent those situations.
So we spoke a little bit about applications on the residential side, the individual resident, maybe the HOA, possibly the property management firm. Let's talk about applications in the government sector or the commercial sector.
Sure. From the government sector and the utility perspective, one of the big advantages here is, again, they're able to see what's going on in their grid and in their delivery of their utility. I know, for example, Park City, they don't have a unique problem, although it is a problem that is there. They have a pretty good altitude. They have to pump up the water into the city. That uses up a lot of electricity. So that's a byproduct byproduct loss in the process of getting the water here. And then getting it up here, the infrastructure isn't brand new. So there's obviously going to be leaks, and it's normal for a city to have leaks throughout the infrastructure. So to be able to locate those leaks, which is another capability of our technology, to locate those leaks allows for the infrastructure provider to fix those and reduce that loss. It's not uncommon for a city to have 15% or more of their water just lost through infrastructure before it even gets to the consumer, which means that you're also losing that amount of energy in pumping that into the infrastructure and keeping it at pressure. So that's a serious issue for a utility provider. Government has mandates in the state of Utah to do real-time benchmarking of their buildings and also to have a reduction of energy. Governor Herbert was very adamant about having that done. When he made that objective or that project, there wasn't really much in the world of real-time metering and monitoring to help make that a reality. But we're seeing now that the cities and the state buildings are moving very quickly to try and reduce their consumption and be responsible stewards of the resources they're given.
What would be a natural progression for this product? What other sorts of ancillary products would complement this? This is not going to be your only product. You'll have other products. What sort of things are you thinking about?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, the constant.
It's wide open, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we get new opportunities all the time, many of which we have to say, you know what, that's a great idea on the use of this data, but you're going to have to wait. So some of the things that we hear about are the oil fields, being able to monitor all the pumps that are throughout oil fields. It's amazing how many pumps there are out there. And many of them, they don't know how efficient their motors are. They don't know how efficient the pump is. They don't know the quality of the oil. They don't know if there are toxic substances on site that might kill someone. So they need to have this information in real time. Now, that one is definitely an interesting one that has pressing opportunity. But again, because our platform is all about getting that changing piece of data in real time, it really didn't matter if it was for a utility or for a gas or an oil pumping company. They needed to know the information in real time. So the world is wide open on the opportunities.
Final question. How many people do you employ here in the Salt Lake Valley, and why Salt Lake?
To date, we actually employ 11, and we're growing very quickly now. We have one employee now from Park City. He's a great guy. So we chose to stay here in Salt Lake City. We were founded here. We went through the Boom Startup Accelerator, which was at the time number 13 in the world for business accelerators. We like Utah. We think that Utah has a lot of progressive ideas. Surprisingly, really, a lot of people don't think Utah would be, but Utah is a great place for very progressive energy reduction goals. We like being here, and we like being a Utah company with Utah employees.
And besides the website that has all sorts of information, again, the website is utility.com. That's utility with a V in the beginning and an I on the end instead of a Y. In addition to telling you about all the different offerings, there's a job posting for, currently a job posting for an engineer. So people that are looking maybe for a job at Utility, you can take a peek at that at utility.com. Steve Ellis, CEO and founder of Utility, thanks so much for joining us. We hope you'll come back and spend some time with us. We'd like to continue to see the progress of your fascinating company.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Great stuff. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Well, when we return, we're going to have a conversation. Actually, it's a previously aired show with Mark O'Connell, who is the Close Encounters man. He's written the Close Encounters Man book, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Beth here, owner of Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. At Peak Art and Frame, we carry a wide variety of framing options, and our design staff can help with any project for your home, office, or gallery. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Steve Ellis, the CEO of Viewtility. Boy, that's really interesting stuff, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
looking forward
cutting
to,
edge.
To staying in touch with that company to see how they do.
That's right. Our next interview is a pre-recorded interview with Mark O'Connell. He has written a book called The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. The book is about Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who's the first astronomer to be recruited by the U.S. Air Force in order to debunk UFO sightings, only to eventually turn around to believe in them. It's like the closer you get to UFOs, the more you start to believe and help establish their scientific validity. Mark O'Connell, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
Well, it's good to have you here. You know, we've all seen these pictures of cave drawings and pictographs from all these different ancient cultures of chariots of fire descending from our sky. But tell us about the last 80 years. How did the modern day fascination with UFOs begin?
That's such a great question. There were some rumblings during World War II. You may have heard of Foo Fighters, which were strange lights that would appear along the wingtips of World War II fighter planes and freak out the pilots. There were also things called ghost rockets in the Scandinavian countries in the 40s. But it really hit home exactly 70 years ago this month. A private pilot named Kenneth Arnold was flying his plane in the Pacific Northwest, and he saw a chain of nine silvery objects flying through the sky at about what he clocked at 1,200 miles an hour. And that was the first modern UFO sighting, and it became national news. The pilot became a huge celebrity, and as soon as his report became news, all sorts of people came out of the woodwork and started reporting their UFO experiences. And all of these reports were being funneled to the U.S. Air Force, and the U.S. Air Force had no idea what to do about this. It quickly became a huge, huge embarrassment for the Air Force because they weren't able to do their job. Here were these strange objects invading our airspace, and the Air Force was apparently completely powerless to stop this from happening or even to explain what was happening. So this is where Dr. Hynek enters the picture. He was a college astronomy professor, and the Air Force brought him in to debunk these UFO reports. Hynek's job was to look at each report and decide whether the object in question was simply a misidentification of an astronomical object. And he was very, very good at this, and he was able to explain away about 80% of the flying saucer reports. It was that 20% that couldn't be explained that became
right.
The issue.
Well, you know, we did some research on you and found that you had written some award-winning screenplays for Star Trek Next Generation. And when I picked up your book and I just read the first two sentences of the prologue, I figured out right away, yeah, this guy knows how to write. I just want to read the first two sentences. We didn't always put our dead aliens on ice or pickle them in jars. We used to give them proper burials. Take us back to 1897 in Aurora, Texas.
Oh, that's a fun chapter in UFO history. Yeah, late 1890s, these mysterious self-propelled airships started to appear all over North America, generally appearing over large cities where they would be guaranteed of attracting huge crowds. They were lighter than air. Well, I shouldn't say they were actually heavier than air, but they could float through the air and they could move into the wind and they could project really brilliant electrical light beams. None of this had ever been seen before. There was, of course, a huge fascination with the development of flight around this time, but nobody had ever actually succeeded. And now here there are these gigantic airships appearing in the sky over American cities like crazy in 1897. And yeah, one appeared over the little town of Aurora, Texas. And according to the story, the flying ship crashed in town and actually struck a windmill and exploded. And there was debris scattered all over town. And it was reported in a Dallas newspaper about 2 days after it happened. And the most curious part of that whole story is that there were the remains of the pilot of the airship were recovered among the wreckage, and he was described as a grotesque being that could only be a Martian. So that's one of the big sort of bellwether moments in history where the idea of invading Martians really began to take hold in the public subconscious.
And they gave him a proper burial in the town cemetery.
Yes, they did. He was buried in the town cemetery, and for all anybody knows, he's still there. People have tried to exhume the body, but they have always been blocked by court orders or law enforcement or sometimes just armed citizens who just sort of show up and block the gates to the cemetery because they don't want anybody digging this guy up.
Which might suggest to those who are believers that it's because his skeletal structure is that of certainly not a human who lives on Earth, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's definitely the thinking.
So the military hires Dr. Joseph Allen Hynek, and they hire him, and you said, I forget your exact wording now, but to debunk, essentially, all of these UFO sightings. But then you also say to decide whether they were real or not. So he debunks about 80% of them. The other 20% are the things that eventually turns him from a debunker into a believer. And I just have to ask you, as you researched for this book, Mark, what did it do for you?
Oh,
in terms of, you know, debunker to believer.
She asks me hard questions all the time, Mark.
I was already a believer, so I started off from a much different place than Dr. Hynek had in the late 1940s. So I didn't really have too far to go, but I did find that I was swayed a great deal by Dr. Hynek's approach to the study of UFOs. He was always reluctant to take a firm stand on what they were. He never committed to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. He was open to multiple different explanations of what could be going on. I found that very impressive, and I've tried to take that into account in my thinking. I've also here's a minor part of the story that had a big effect on me. When I started looking through Hynek's personal professional files at Northwestern University in their archives, I came across dozens and dozens and dozens of letters written to Dr. Hynek from people all over the world who would say, I want to tell you about my UFO experience. And then they would go on for 10 or 20 pages describing their UFO experience. Or they'd say, I want to tell you about my new theory of reality. And then they'd go on for 10 or 20 pages. And I would look at these letters and think, oh, my God, I don't know how I would respond to this. Mm-hmm. But you get into his files and you see these responses that he would write to people. And he basically felt like, look, if you have an idea to share, then you deserve to be heard. And so he would read these letters and he would send back 10 or 20 page responses going over point by point. Well, now here's where I agree with you, here's where I disagree with you. And I was so struck by the fact that he was willing to give so much time and attention to people who had just all variety of beliefs about UFOs. I was so impressed with that, with his attitude to that, that I tried to bring that attitude to my research and my writing of the book. Mm. Anybody who's got a story to tell about this phenomenon deserves to be heard.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit of what seems to me a preponderance of stories about UFO sightings during the, you know, the late 40s, the 50s. Now, we don't, at least, I don't find that we're seeing a lot of UFOs. Is it that we now explain everything away to ourselves as, oh, that's a satellite or that's some kind of spacecraft? Whereas back then, we were more creative in our thinking or more willing to believe?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting point. And one of the things that struck me in my research was I had to sort of readjust my mindset and put myself in the shoes of somebody in 1947 or 1948 who saw something strange in the sky and realized this is a person who has never seen a rocket launch, either live or on TV news. This is a person who has never seen a jet airplane. These are technologies that they were known at the time, they were in development at the time, but nobody had seen them. So I tried to put myself in that mindset of, okay, if I had never seen these things and I saw something strange in the sky, how would I interpret it? How would I describe it? And that's always a stumbling block because, of course, nobody knows how to describe it. Hynek would always point out, look, these people are trying to describe something using a vocabulary that simply doesn't exist. So, you know, these are the stumbling blocks to understanding the phenomenon. But I definitely think that if you can try to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's seen these things in different times and just see it through their frame of reference, it does help to understand what the phenomenon represents, what it means.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Mark O'Connell. He's written a fascinating book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. Well, we are in Park City, Utah here this morning. And so let's bring this back to Utah, to Tremonton, Utah in July of 1952. Yeah. And we'll also bring in, of course, Hill Air Force Base in Ogden, Utah. There is 50 feet of film that defied all experts and possibly brought Hynek to the other side. Tell us about that.
It is such a good story, and it's really, for me, one of the most convincing UFO stories out there. A family out on vacation, driving near Tremonton, Utah. They're out on a lonely highway, as so often happens in UFO reports. And the wife looks out the window of the car and says, hey, what's that in the sky? There are 15 or 20 bright balls of light sort of cavorting about in the blue sky. And the husband sees it and pulls over to the side of the road. And the husband turns out to be a Navy photographer who has thousands of hours of flight time. So this is a guy who understands how flying machines work, and he also understands how light works because of his photography work. So he gets his Bell and Howell movie camera out of the trunk of the car and starts filming these objects in the sky. And when you watch the movie, and you can find it anywhere online, you can find it on YouTube and all sorts of places. When you watch this film and you start to sort of see how these objects move about, at first it seems kind of random, but after a few seconds it sort of seems a little rhythmic, a little cyclical. These objects are sort of grouping together and then moving apart. And so the Navy photographer gets this film developed and sends it up the chain of command. And it winds up being reported to Project Blue Book, the Air Force project that Hynek worked for. But more importantly, it ends up being analyzed by our country's best photo analysts. These are the people who confirmed to JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis that, yes, there are nuclear missiles in Cuba, you know, based on satellite photographs. So these are people who really know their way around photographic images. And they put thousands of man hours into analyzing this short movie film, and they come to the conclusion that these objects are not birds, they are not airplanes, they are not balloons. They are light-emitting objects of unknown origin, and we really need to take a closer look at this. So it's just fascinating that we have this movie film that, in my opinion, is pretty strong evidence that there is something very strange going on in the sky. And, of course, it ended up, you know, the last scene of Raiders in the Lost Ark where the Ark ends up being stored in this gigantic warehouse.
Oh, yeah.
Full of all sorts of crates, you know, endless rows of crates. That's kind of what happened to that movie film. It's just sort of, you know, it was in the possession of the Army or the Air Force, and it's just kind of, I don't know if anyone knows where the original version is, but it sure would be nice to find, because I would like to have my dream UFO investigation would be to hire the best special effects wizards in the film industry and have them analyze this film, not just frame by frame, but pixel by pixel, and really try to determine exactly what is being seen in that film.
So Ogden, Utah, July 1952, was that 50 feet of film turned Hynek. Is there any one piece of evidence or story that has that convinced you to come to become a believer?
Well, for me, it was a pretty short walk from to believer, because I was always fascinated in the topic. A big event for me was in 1973. I was 13 years old at the time, and there was an alleged alien abduction that took place in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Two men were fishing on a pier in the middle of the night, and they were basically kidnapped by these strange robotic beings and floated aboard a UFO and examined and then deposited back out on the pier where they had been fishing. This case just became instantly world famous. It was in the news constantly. And for me, a 13-year-old kid, my only exposure to UFO stories up to this point had been what I read in books from the library. And now suddenly there's this UFO event, spectacular event, that is being reported on in the news. You're hearing it on the radio. I'm seeing it on the TV news. I'm seeing it in the newspaper. So for me, that was the moment at which the UFO phenomenon really became real for me. And at that point, there was absolutely no turning back. And I still find that case one of the most fascinating and puzzling cases in history.
Wow. Well, it's we just have a few minutes remaining with you, unfortunately. But give us something that's happened recently that further cements your belief.
Ooh. Well, there hasn't been anything just within the most immediate time frame, but I can tell you this. I've spent a couple years volunteering for the Mutual UFO Network as a UFO field investigator, and over the last couple years, I've heard some amazing stories from people who I consider to be pretty reliable witnesses of some events that they experienced, but they weren't modern occurrences. In the two cases I'm thinking of, these were people who after keeping their experience a secret for 10 or 20 or even 30 years, decided that they had to get it off their chest, and they reported it to MUFON online, and then the cases were assigned to me. So I had the privilege of talking to these two people. Two cases in particular. I don't think we have time to go into them unless you can tell me otherwise, but very, very fascinating stories that I simply cannot explain. And as I said, the witnesses in these two cases are, to me, exceptionally credible. I've spent a lot of time talking with both of these people and have never detected the faintest shred of any kind of artifice or dishonesty.
Mark O'Connell, who is an award-winning writer for Star Trek Next Generation series, has written a book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Mark O'Connell. I love talking about UFOs.
Me too.
Why not? Well, KPCW Pledge Drive coming up August 21st through 24th. The Back Alley Bash, which is, you know, it's the greatest summer party, is taking place on August 18th. The solar eclipse is happening on the 21st. I don't know what that has to do with KPCW Pledge Drive, but our fearless leader, KPCW General Manager Renee Bodley, in the studio with us to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning. You have to be fearless to come in and chat with you guys. Tough crowd. Okay, so your listeners are probably wondering, it's August 3rd, Pledge Drive is August 21st, Back Alley Bash August 18th. Why are they talking about this now? The reason we're talking about it now is because so often during Pledge Drive, our development team will get a phone call from someone saying, hey, I want to donate a premium, a gift, mm-hmm. you know, because when you make a $50 pledge to KPCW, you often get a $25 gift certificate to something. And there are a lot of businesses who recognize the value of having their name said over and over and over again during those 4 days. They decide they want to be part of that, but by the time Pledge Drive starts, it's too late. So we thought we'd remind everybody sooner rather than later. And we thought with the public affairs shows, because you guys have such devoted listeners, such a big fan base, that we wanted to make sure they knew about the opportunity as well.
Okay, so I've got a listening audience out there that's wondering how they're going to get their restaurant gift certificate to you. How do they?
Good question. They should email either jennifer@kpcw.org. That's Jennifer Kimball Bailey, our Director of Marketing and Events. She is working heavily with Pledge Drive because our new Director of Development, Kim Crittenden, just joined us a couple months ago. And so we're all kind of watching Jen as she goes through this Pledge Drive routine. So either jennifer@kpcw.org or kim@kpcw.org. Please contact them, or you can just call the station main number, 435-645-9004.
It's actually 649-9004.
Now, it may not be a business. It could be an individual that has a great vacation home that they would like to put up on the auction. And so we need auction items. We need larger items for our auction.
Great point, JW. Thank you for mentioning that. The online auction has some wonderful deals, and you can get to that online auction through our website, kpcw.org. Right now, the only item that we are showing, because the auction is not live yet, is that Remington bronze that someone donated to the station. A gentleman who sold his home in Heber didn't want to move the 9-foot-tall Remington bronze to his new home in Florida, so he gave it to the station
Wow.
for us to sell. So if somebody is out there with their big, beautiful new house or yard, or they want that artwork, I've seen it in person. You can go to Heber and see it in person. It's beautiful. It's the rattlesnake one. It's the one where the rider's on the horse and the rattlesnake's on the ground and the horse is stuck
rears
in it.
Up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So it's a casting of a Remington, and it's beautiful. And we have it online for a $15,000 buy it now bid. But we're not quite sure where we're going to start the bidding. But you can buy it right now for $15,000. It's appraised at $20,000.
Excellent. Thanks for stopping by, Renee. And also, if you see JW or me in the supermarket, on the golf course, on the trails, wherever you might see us, the no name. Roof, perhaps?
We could be abducted by aliens. We could be on an alien spacecraft after our last guest. And they may want to donate.
But if you see us and you want to donate, you can tell us. We'll make sure the message gets to Renee, Kim, or Jennifer. And we've got a few more underwriters. It's Cool Science Radio. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Any last word, Renee?
Nope. Thank you. And thank you to all your listeners. You guys do a great job.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And thanks to our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. It's time.